Chief Justice Steele, members of the court, my name is Joseph Bernstein, and I'm representing the appellant, Ramazan Shaheen. Before I get started, I'd like to introduce my colleague, Philip Lowers, member of the Pennsylvania Bar, who's of counsel in this case, assisting me. I'm going to confine my arguments to the ineffective assistance of counsel issue, and I'm going to rely on the brief for the appearance, or what I'm going to call the appearance of bias issue. But if the court has any questions about that latter issue, I'd be glad to entertain them now or at the end of the argument, whatever you choose. I'd like to speak briefly to start out with the direct appeal in this case. And if the court will recall, what the court did was the defense tried to raise a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel on direct appeal, which the court typically does not entertain, and they did not entertain it in this case, but expressed some fairly strong language, some concerns about what the trial counsel had done in the trial, and allowed the defendant, even though the convictions were affirmed, and the court expressed some opinions about the ineffectiveness issue, they were all without prejudice to the defendant filing a Rule 61 claim alleging ineffective assistance of counsel.
And that's why we're here today. Mr. Bernstein, over here.
Yes.
Didn't we address in the direct appeal whether the test was Cronic or Strickland?
Yes, you did. And
is that raised judicata?
No. I would say no. And here's why. The court affirmed the convictions, but basically said, we don't have enough of a record here to decide the ineffectiveness claim. So we're going to allow the defendant, without prejudice, to bring that claim so we can have the benefit of a full record. And I would suggest to the court that in the same spirit of having a full record to decide the case, the court should not consider itself bound by what the court said about Strickland versus Cronic in this appeal, because if that were so, it wouldn't be without prejudice.
Well, and why wouldn't that distinction though be the law of the case here? Because we clearly know what the Cronic standard is, and we know what the Strickland standard is, and we're saying in the direct appeal, Cronic didn't apply, and nothing we say here about affirming your convictions precludes you from raising ineffective assistance under Strickland.
I think the answer to that is that I'm going to say the court jumped the gun, because the court conceded we don't have the whole record in front of us. And I would suggest, as a matter of fairness, the court should not apply either res judicata or the law of the case when the court itself conceded.
So this is just loose language? Is that, idle talk?
I'm not saying it's idle talk, but what I am saying is that the court shouldn't consider itself, its hands tied, because the court itself conceded, we're not deciding this case because we don't have the whole picture.
Well, let me get at it another way. Can you tell us what expanded record there is that would warrant considering it under Cronic?
Well, I think what the
and
court...
And what I'm talking about is something that was not known to the court when the appeal was taken.
Well, I really didn't focus on what was known or what was not known, because I approached this case as kind of writing on a clean slate based on the record that was made in the trial court on the ineffectiveness issue, and focused on what did the trial attorney do.
But you're asking us to apply Cronic, aren't you?
Yes, I think under the facts of this case.
And you're suggesting that the reason why the court should apply Cronic is because on the direct appeal there wasn't a full record, and now there's a more complete record. So I'd like to know what the added facts are that would warrant consideration under Cronic.
Well, I don't know what the added facts are, but I know what the facts are.
Well, didn't the court know what the facts were, too?
I don't know, because the court's opinion is the court said some of the things counsel did were troubling. And I made kind of a bullet list of what was developed post-direct appeal that I believe warrants application of Cronic rather than Strickland.
Well, that's Justice Berger's question. So tell us the bullet points that were developed post-direct appeal.
The first one was that defense counsel told the judge that the defendant had rejected a plea offer. It didn't say what the plea offer was, but communicated a rejection of the plea offer, and it was against the strong advice of counsel. That was communicated to the court. He also told the court that the defendant wasn't cooperative in preparing for trial. He wouldn't disclose what he was going to say. He was uncooperative in trying to develop evidence, witnesses. That was communicated to the trial court.
That wasn't before us in direct appeal?
I'm sorry?
Those facts weren't before this court in direct appeal?
I don't recall whether they were. I don't think that was.
Well, either there were new facts developed post-conviction or there weren't.
Well,
if there are, we need to know. If there aren't,
I guess in my mind I didn't distinguish between new facts
and we're asking
facts.
You to distinguish now.
Standing here right now, I probably couldn't do it. But I know what facts I'm relying on.
Let's see if we can approach this from the proposition, whether it's what we conclude later or not, that there's language in the direct appeal opinion that's improvident, considering the fact that it refers to an opportunity to develop a fuller record. So just give us your bullet points, and we'll move
on. Okay. The third one is the defense counsel expressed an opinion that the defendant wouldn't present himself very well, that he might make outbursts, that he was somebody, whether it was a jury, and I think the main reason they elected to go with a bench trial was because of defense counsel's belief that the defendant would not be liked by the jury. That was expressed to the court. There was also an expression of a personal opinion, in effect, in so many words, that the defendant was guilty. There was a very, and this I remember did come out in the post-conviction proceedings and did not come out in the direct appeal. Trial counsel expressed a very significant expression of just plain frustration with the client, that it was like, I don't know what to do. I'm telling him to take a plea, and he's telling me he wants to go to trial, and I don't want to go to trial because this case is a slam dunk loser, and I'm at my wit's end. And that frustration came through very clearly in the evidentiary hearing. That's something I now can say was not before this court. He also expressed comments about the credibility of the defendant when he said he needed an interpreter and told the trial judge that he thought the defendant was, quote, playing dumb, unquote. In the closing argument, and I think this is another thing that wasn't presented or considered by the court in the direct appeal, trial counsel talked about, he really did these things, but it's a cultural thing, as if to kind of offer an excuse for his behavior, which basically sent the message that he's guilty, but it's a cultural thing, but even in his culture, he can't rape prostitutes. Those are the points that I would suggest to the court under Cook amounted to what this court described as structural defects that undermined the confidence in the court and the verdict. And I think the best way to understand Cook is to, rather than look at the majority opinion first, look at the dissenting opinion in Cook and see what the majority rejected. The dissenting opinion in Cook basically said, look, the trial attorneys did a pretty good job here. They didn't have a lot to work with, but they did a pretty good job. The outcome, because of the overwhelming nature of the evidence, was foreseen, and in fact there was nothing that the defense counsel could have done, even if they went along with Cook's desire for a not guilty plea, that would have changed the outcome. And the majority in Cook said, wait a minute, you're approaching this the wrong way. It's not whether they did a good job overall or whether the outcome would have changed. They threw their client under the bus. That was a struggle. They told the jury that he's guilty but mentally ill, when the client did not want to pursue that defense and wanted to pursue an all-out acquittal. In this case, much like Cook, defense counsel threw his client under the bus by attacking his credibility, telling the judge about the guilty, the plea offers, expressing his frustration with his client's refusal to take the plea offer, ascribing his conduct to cultural differences. And I would suggest to the court that all of those things that I just went through, maybe they're not as extreme as what happened in Cook, but it's the same kind of animal. Irrespective of counsel's overall performance and irrespective of would the result have changed.
So let me just make sure I get this. You're saying that even though in this case trial counsel didn't formally concede that his client concede guilt, he did so de facto, that is, by casting all sorts of aspersions upon his client's credibility and character. Is that your point?
There wasn't an express concession of guilt, but I would agree with the de facto concession of guilt.
Well, I understand your argument under Cronic. Now, let's just switch to Strickland. Under your Cronic argument, you're saying the focus isn't on whether the result would have been different because he basically didn't have an attorney, so Cronic should apply. But if we switch to Strickland, where you have to show cause and prejudice, here the cause would be the conduct of the attorney as you described it. But when we get to the prejudice prong, we look at the state's evidence. And under Strickland, is it possible for your client to show prejudice?
No.
So under Strickland,
I agree with it. I'm going to concede that.
So we concede that he, under Strickland, he couldn't prevail, and his only hope is to say that the whatever we said about Cronic was either dicta or clearly erroneous, and we should go back and apply Cronic to these facts.
Well, I don't think you have to. My point is what this court said in the direct appeal about Strickland applying was made on an incomplete record, and the court should not consider itself bound by what it said in the direct appeal.
We understand that. If we conclude that Cronic doesn't apply, then under Strickland the conviction would
be dead in the water.
Okay, so that's the issue.
That's correct.
Cronic or not Cronic.
Now the court in Cook could have applied Strickland and specifically rejected that, because that was the argument that the dissent made in Cook. Look, they did an overall good job, and the evidence was overwhelming. How can he possibly, and if the court had applied Strickland in Cook, Cook would have lost, because the evidence was overwhelming, and there was no way that the defendant could show prejudice. This case is like that in that sense.
In this case, your client pleaded not guilty, and the defense counsel argued for a not guilty verdict?
I would disagree with that.
No argument for a not guilty verdict or judgment?
Well, he presented what the client wanted to present as a defense, that, yes, I raped some prostitutes, but not these prostitutes. There's some other ones.
Well, what did defense counsel ask the trial judge to rule at the end?
I don't think he specifically said anything that explicit, I want you to acquit him. He basically proffered the cultural differences. It's like guilty with an explanation.
But he did proffer the defense that he's not guilty of raping the particular alleged victims in this case.
He said that, and he also said, you got to understand the cultural differences here, which in my mind is a concession of guilt. It's guilty with an explanation.
So that's your argument as to why this case is parallel to Cook?
I think all of the things that I cited as bullet points, I'm going to call them, when you add them all up, it's the same kind of structural defect that the court recognized in Cook. And the state, if you read the state's brief, is making the very same arguments. Counsel did an overall good job. There was no way that, no matter what counsel did, to achieve a not guilty verdict, the evidence was overwhelming.
Well, but the state also argues in their brief that defense counsel cross-examined witnesses, put on a vigorous defense, did what defense counsel normally does.
Overall,
in a case.
Did a good job.
Let me finish.
I'm not quarreling with it.
You're interrupting me. Overall, did what a defense counsel should do in defending a client on the basis that he's not guilty.
And the majority in Cook rejected that argument. That was the dissent's argument in Cook.
But the facts were different, weren't they? I mean, in Cook, the plea that was pursued by the lawyers against the wishes of the client was guilty but mentally ill. Here, there was no guilty but mentally ill. It was not guilty. So all we have are disparaging remarks made by counsel about client's credibility, client's character, and that's what you're arguing is substantially the same as a formal
plea.
I'm
saying the same kind of structural errors that infect the entire trial, irrespective of the fact that counsel might have done an overall good job. I agree with that.
So in essence, you're saying that any time defense counsel makes any comments that are negative about his client, that means that the client didn't get the benefit of counsel.
The issue of the problem client who doesn't want to do what the lawyer thinks is in the client's best interest is probably, for a defense attorney, the toughest problem that you face, and it's faced every day in every court
in this state. Isn't that exactly the point, that defense attorneys regularly deal with problem defendants and express some frustration or negativity toward the court, not toward the court, but negativity in the way the defense attorney feels about his client, and yet that's not ineffective assistance of counsel.
Most competent attorneys, if they have those opinions, will keep them to themselves. They will not express it to the court or the jury or tell anybody.
Is that
the lawyer who does what the trial lawyer did in this case crosses the line?
Let me ask you this question. Is there any significance in the fact that the fact finder here was an experienced trial judge familiar with criminal law practice in the state, as opposed to comments of this kind being made in the presence of a jury?
Intellectually, I don't think it should make a difference. I'm sure in the court's mind, you know, where there's a bench trial, many times the judge will allow hearsay. You know, you take it all in and you sort it out later.
Yeah, it might very well be that the judge in Superior Court who sits on a case review day and knows that a plea has been offered and rejected case review ultimately becomes the judge at trial. Does that have any significance in the case where the judge is the
fact finder? I think usually that, at least the practice in Newcastle County was, the judge who takes pleas at case review would never be a trial judge. They're always a son of somebody else.
Well, that's a luxury.
So that situation doesn't occur.
Yeah, that's a luxury in Newcastle County where there's so many trial judges.
I'm just speaking from anecdotal experience.
Well, my point is, I guess, transparent. It is that what's the big deal, by way of example, of expressing to the trial judge the fact that there had been a plea and the plea had been rejected?
Well,
all in a day's work.
Well, then you get into the appearance of impropriety issue. Would an objective observer, knowing all those facts, have some doubt that the trial judge could be fair, even though the trial judge, in his or her own mind, was absolutely convinced that even though I know these extra judicial things, I can still be fair? And I would suggest that this court's case law answers no to that. That if there's an objective appearance of bias, meaning an objective outside observer test, that this
means an objective observer being someone who knows nothing about criminal procedure?
No, knows the facts.
But knows nothing about the workings inside the Criminal Justice Administration. This objective observer has to be someone like a chemical engineer or school bus driver.
I think that's the test. I think that's what this court said in, I think it was Stevenson. I don't have the site in front of me, but this court has consistently adopted the federal although the court does look at the subjective aspect, the paramount question is the objective observer test.
Okay, did you want to save your 2 minutes?
I'm going to save whatever time I have left.
All right.
Thank you very much. It's always a pleasure.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Josette Manning on behalf of the State of Delaware. I would like to first start with some comments that were made by Mr. Bernstein, the first being that this case is like Cook and that guilt was conceded. That is not the case. This is not like Cook. Guilt was absolutely not conceded. This was a contested trial. Defense counsel cross-examined every witness but one, and the one that he didn't was because she helped him significantly, and that's the witness, the victim, that he moved for judgment of acquittal on. His closing argument was basically an insufficiency of the evidence argument. He attacked the witnesses individually. He attacked their inconsistencies, their ability to recall based on their drug use and their alcohol use. He did make a cultural reference, and he explained when he made that reference that it was not to excuse, but to rebut the state's argument that the defendant knew exactly what he was doing when he did this.
Ms. Manning, suppose the facts were the same, but the trial was a jury trial. Would your position be different?
Yes, Your Honor. It would be different. A judge in a bench trial has a unique gatekeeping function. They are the arbiter of the law, and they are also the trier of fact, and that places them in a unique position. They are going to see and hear things that would not be presented to a lay jury. So that is the distinction when it is before.
Let me refine my question. Would it be different, that is, would the result be different in the sense that chronic would apply, or would the result be different in the sense that Strickland would apply, but there would be prejudice?
The latter. Strickland would still apply. Chronic does not apply to this case.
And it wouldn't even if it was a jury trial.
That's correct, Your Honor. This case, as this court noted on direct appeal, needs to be analyzed under Strickland. It does not fit into any of the three chronic exceptions. The Supreme Court in Bell v. Cohn specifically stated that a failure of counsel, which is what Mr. Sahin is arguing under, that exception, must be complete. That is not the case here. There are instances of deficient conduct. The state concedes that. However, there is not a complete failure that rises to the level of chronic.
Let me make sure I understand what you said a moment ago. If we were to assume that this is, a jury trial instead of in front of a judge, is the state then conceding that under Strickland there would be a finding of prejudice?
It's possible, Your Honor. I don't believe that juries are held to the same standard that judges are. Judges hear motions to suppress. They preside at final case reviews. They have a lot of knowledge.
Right.
That
I understand that juries are different than judges. I'm asking whether the state's position is that this exact same case with everything done the same way in front of a jury would be a basis for a new trial under Strickland because there would be prejudice?
I understand your question, Your Honor. Thank you. No, because in this case, although that would increase the amount of prejudice to Mr. Sahin, there would not have been a substantial likelihood of a different outcome had those comments not been made. The evidence in this case was absolutely overwhelming. His own statements during trial, formed as the judge stated at sentencing, were the strongest evidence presented. Frankly.
Thank you.
As for the new evidence that was presented at the Rule 61 proceeding, essentially what came out of that from the state's perspective was defense counsel's explanation and certainly apologies for the comments that were made, but that his motivation was that he knew the only way to keep Mr. Sahin out of jail for multiple life sentences was to be before a judge who knew the penalties and who knew that the state had accepted a reduction to that sentence. He recognized the evidence was strong, and he knew a judge was less likely to accumulate that evidence against Mr. Sahin at trial. That's the state's perspective as to what came out of that hearing. There was absolutely no other factual evidence that came out of that proceeding that this court was not aware of during direct appeal.
Well, question that raises is whether what came out in the Rule 61 proceeding, although it may have been new, was material in terms of the analysis that we have to employ here.
Yes, Your Honor. It was not material to the decision of whether Cook or Strickland applies. No. The court in the direct appeal had asked why those comments were made. We were interested in knowing why those comments had been made. That question was answered by defense counsel, but it did not change the analysis or what standard would be applied appropriately in this case. The other interesting facts that go to the fact that guilt was not conceded here, defense counsel presented Mr. Sahin as a witness. As this court is aware, when a witness is called to testify in the narrative, that telegraphs to any judge that there's a reason behind it, and that reason is that counsel doesn't believe their client. And in this case, defense counsel asked Mr. Sahin and directed him and asked him questions through his testimony as further evidence that he was not impugning his client's credibility. The statements that were made regarding the interpreter, the worst of those comments were made only after the judge had made her own opinion based upon what she heard and what she experienced sitting in that courtroom. The most damning comment about Mr. Sahin playing dumb was only after the judge had made the comment that, in her opinion, He understands English just fine, based on what she observed in the courtroom. And that is what she said. It was not based upon what defense counsel said or what the state said. It was based upon her interactions with the defendant, her questions and answers, his responses to her answers. So she had formed that opinion. And that was not a finding as to his credibility, but a finding as to whether or not he needed an interpreter. And that was a matter that had to be figured out by the court at that time. The judge had a duty to answer that question.
Well, on that point and all the others that relate to what defense counsel told the judge that arguably, if viewed by an objective individual, would cause an objective individual to doubt that he had received a fair trial, or words to that effect. What's your response to the objective standard in determining whether or not Mr. Saheem was prejudiced by having that particular judge, having heard those comments, sit as the fact finder and the render of the final judgment in his case?
He was not prejudiced, Your Honor. The appearance of bias standard, as this court discussed in Jackson, is would a reasonable person's trust in the system be tested? No lay person who sat in on this trial would mistrust the system based on what went on or doubt the impartiality of the trial judge in this case. The judge who stated that she didn't believe he needed an interpreter still ensured that he had that interpreter. In fact, even after that was decided and there was some issue about whether or not 911 calls and statements that had been recorded in English needed to be translated live during trial, the judge raised that issue on her own and asked, do we need to do this? And went back and forth with counsel and asked counsel, really think about this. This is a big deal. What should we do here? Because she was that concerned about fairness and making sure that Mr. Saheem understood everything that was going on. During that conversation, it became clear, based on defense counsel's representation to the court with Mr. Saheem present, that Mr. Saheem did not need to have the English statements translated because he had heard them himself two or three times. The court went on to have the interpreter present despite that. An objective observer would have seen that. An objective observer would have heard the court promise him a fair trial on multiple occasions. They would have certainly seen the evidence come in. They would have heard him testify. They would have heard his statements that were played in open court, lengthy interviews in English. The judgment about whether or not he was hedging or using it as a delay tactic with the interpreter is a separate issue from his credibility as a witness and in those statements. And that credibility was never attacked. The defense counsel never went after his credibility as a witness. In fact, in his closing, touted him as being candid. And in his cross-examination, asked him, you were being honest with the police, weren't you? Answer, yes. So there was never any impugning of his credibility in the sense of a witness or someone testifying at trial. A reasonable person would have heard the judge correct the state when they were doing closing arguments, and the judge interrupted and said, alleged rapes, reminding the state that they were just allegations at that time. And at sentencing, the judge noted that the most compelling evidence was the defendant's own statement, so indicating that she was not swayed by anything other than the evidence that was put before her by the state, which was compelling in this case.
Well, I'm still struggling with the objective standard that Mr. Bernstein explained to us in his argument, and let me particularize it. I suspect that we would have serious questions if a jury heard from defense counsel that his client had rejected what defense counsel thought to be a very fair and provident plea offer. That would raise quite an eyebrow, I suspect.
Yes.
Given the objective standard Mr. Bernstein explained, even if you don't agree with it, you can articulate your own, why should we not be troubled with the fact that the trial judge sitting as a fact finder and ultimate render of the judgment knew that there had been a plea offer that was rejected that defense counsel, by his language, suggested his client should have accepted?
It presumes that knowledge implied something negative to the judge. That knowledge could have easily implied to the judge that Mr. Saheem was innocent and was going to fight for his innocence, that he would reject such a benevolent offer, as defense counsel had put it. And
is that what an objective individual looking from the outside would conclude? Or is that what somebody with 43 years experience practicing law would conclude?
It's a fair question, Your Honor. I think under the objective standard, it probably would not have meant much at all to a layperson. These are conversations that are had on the record at final case reviews in courtrooms all the time. The plea agreement and rejection forms are in the file. It is something that the court is now inquiring even more, given the recent Supreme Court cases about the acceptance and rejection of pleas. They have that knowledge, and that
are you suggesting that even if defense counsel had said nothing with respect to a plea offer, that the trial judge sitting as the fact finder and the ultimate renderer of judgment would know, because it would be in her file, that there had been a plea offer and had been rejected?
That's a possibility, yes, Your Honor.
Would she also have known that it was against defense counsel's advice to reject the plea? The file wouldn't reflect which way defense counsel came down on that, would it?
It would not, Your Honor. Unless that judge had presided over a final case review where a discussion was had on the record, which is common. And so that would be unique that that would happen. And the state is not saying that those comments should have been made, that it should have gone that far. We concede that those comments should not have been made. However, when we are using the objective observer standard, it has to take in the totality of the circumstances. It cannot be looked at in isolation. And to look at that one comment in isolation as defense counsel selling out his client or, you know, quote, throwing him under the bus, when you look at the rest of the entirety of the trial, no objective observer would be able to say that that is what happened in this case.
Well, I think that's one of the problems with the objective observer test. That is, what qualities do we attribute to the objective observer? And I think that's, you know, that was the gist of the Chief Justice's question. Is there any law on that issue?
Other than that it is a layperson, that it's a reasonable layperson, and that what this court talked about in Jackson. And it said that the standard is a very potent tool, but it does not invalidate every verdict in every case, even if there is some appearance. That's the other issue here. Even if this court finds that there was some appearance, is it sufficient appearance of bias or impartiality to overturn the verdict? Is it sufficient to shake a reasonable person's trust in the criminal justice system? And in this case, under the totality of the circumstances, no. Given the evidence and given the way the trial proceeded, defense counsel's handling of the case as well as the trial judge's handling of the case.
Don't we have to attribute to this hypothetical reasonable observer the knowledge that the fact finder here is a judge with years of experience who hears this sort of thing all the time? I mean, if that isn't factored into the equation, then why would this case be any different from the one where the comments were made to a jury, a lay jury?
There is the subjective component of the trial judge during the recusal process where the standard is typically applied, but because there was not a motion for recusal and that issue was not addressed, we don't have that subjective prong to the test. And unfortunately, it is a sort of unique way to come at it because we don't have that evidence in front of us. We would only have the test of the objective observer. And one of the important things about the objective observer test as it has been applied in recusal situations is that the information has to come from an extrajudicial source. And in this case, any of the issues that occurred, her credibility determination, the judge's credibility determinations, the judge's opinions about the interpreter, all of those things came through this case during this trial from her interactions.
An intrajudicial source.
Yes, Your Honor. Which would take it outside of any issue with an objective appearance of bias. I appreciate the court's difficulty with the reasonable person and who that is and what we can attribute to them. And unfortunately, that is a difficulty with the standard. However, it would have to be such that it impacted a person's belief in the judicial system and that the judge could not be impartial. And the comments in this case, in light of the evidence and the actions of defense counsel and the court, just simply don't rise to that level. Mr. Sahin suffered absolutely no prejudice in this case, and none of his fundamental rights were impacted. Defense counsel's comments did not create an appearance of bias surrounding the trial judge's ability to assess Mr. Sahin's credibility. This court has ruled it is res judicata. This case needs to be analyzed under Strickland, and Mr. Sahin's counsel has conceded that under Strickland they do not prevail. If the court has no further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just a couple of brief comments. Ms. Manning talked about the chronic as a very narrow decision. And I would respond to that by saying that this court, reading the Cook opinion, in my opinion, went beyond chronic, which this court can do. The U.S. Supreme Court has said what the U.S. Supreme Court says about something is the floor. States are always free to grant more protection in terms of the right to counsel, for example, in this case, than the U.S. Supreme Court does. And I would suggest to the court that that's what this court did in Cook. They took chronic and breathed some life into it, I would say. And in doing so, may have afforded more protection than chronic would have afforded, which is this court's right to do. And the U.S. Supreme Court has said that over and over again. And this court, especially in the search and seizure area, has given defendants more protection than the federal courts are given under the Fourth Amendment. I can think of a half a dozen cases where this court has said we can give more protection, and we're doing that. And so I would reject the argument that if you just look at chronic, the appellant loses. I think you have to look at it and say, does the appellant lose under Cook? And you have to look, Cook is the starting point, not chronic. The other point I would make is a reasonable observer. Nobody knows what the reasonable observer is, but I would kind of analogize it to the, I forget which Supreme Court justice says, I can't define pornography, but I know I want to see it. Kind of like that approach. If it doesn't pass the smell test, it's probably bad.
Thank you, Mr. Bernstein.
Thank you.
And I want to make one comment. You mentioned that it's always a pleasure to come before this court. Now, I'm not going to raise any skepticism about how well you believe that, but I do want to say that it's always a pleasure for this court for you to appear before us, because you're always well prepared, articulate, and precise in your argument. So thank you
very much.
And Ms. Manning, I want to say to you, I don't know if this is your first argument before me or not. I think it probably is, but I know you've been before a panel before. But we definitely look forward to your continuing appearance on behalf of the state in future cases.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement and recess.